Hey, podcast listeners, it's Anne here. And I don't know about you, but I'm having kind of a hard time these days, cutting through the bitterness and polarization that's all around us. So for a change, here's a story about hope and idealism. A story about a guy who went looking for enlightenment and wound up helping to eliminate one of the worst diseases in history. His name is Larry Brilliant. He's a doctor. And he's one of the key players in the fight to defeat smallpox. In fact, he presided over the last known cases. He also founded a nonprofit that cured more than 2 million cases of blindness. And he also directed Google.org. But none of this is how he started out. In his new memoir, Sometimes Brilliant, Larry tells the story of how he met Martin Luther King Jr. in college and joined the civil rights movement. And then he got swept up in the whole summer of love, psychedelic hippie thing. Eventually, he landed in the Himalayas at an Indian ashram where his guru told him that he was destined to cure smallpox. As Larry told Steve Paulson, his whole life has been an unlikely series of events, starting with becoming a hippie.
Well, I was from Detroit, Michigan, which I think explains that I hadn't seen very much of the coasts. And I certainly was unprepared for what I would see in the summer of love in San Francisco. And it really wasn't fair to do to a young boy like me from Detroit, Michigan. And I didn't resist, I have to confess. It was like opening up a candy box to a kid. And that candy box was freedom and self-expression, playfulness, a sense of humor, a little bit too much hedonism.
Sex, drugs, and rock and roll is what you're talking about,
sex,
right?
Sex, drugs, and rock and roll without any question. And it was amazing. And it wasn't just hedonism, hedonism, hedonism. It was, this is the beginning of the age of Aquarius. This is a time of freedom and justice and partying. All of those things wrapped into one at the corner of Haight and Ashbury. And to top it all off, I was there during the summer as a government employee, and I had a job, which was to check hospitals for discrimination. But indeed, that was my day job. At night, my job was to understand the counterculture. You're quite right about that.
Mm. So you basically became a hippie doctor.
I hadn't yet become a hippie doctor. That happened when I met Wavy Gravy.
Wavy Gravy, the famous sort of clown prince of the counterculture.
Yes. Then my transformation from activist to hippie was complete. But that only happened when I came and did my internship in 69, again in San Francisco. And a group of Native Americans had taken over Alcatraz. And Herb Cain, who was the famous columnist, kept on writing, there's no water, there's no electricity, there's no medicine, there's a woman here, Paiute Sioux woman, who wants to deliver her baby. And is there no doctor who's willing to come and break through the Coast Guard embargo and come on the island and bring medical supplies and make her delivery safe and healthy? And I thought that was like they'd written an ad for Larry Brilliant, please come on Alcatraz. And just seemed, and my wife agreed, you know, it seemed like that was the right thing for me to do. So I didn't hesitate. I went out there. And when I got out there and the baby was born and I assisted, and on the way back, a young Indian had taken too much of a pharmacological support system. And he had been a Green Beret in Vietnam. And he started cutting his own wrists. And I would sew them up, and he would pull out the sutures, and the Coast Guard medevaced all of us. And then when we finally got him in his bleeding state off the island, the ambulances were waiting at Pier 38 or whatever the pier was that we landed at, and so were the TV cameras. There were all these television cameras asking me, what do the Indians want? And I had not met an Indian until 4 weeks earlier. But I was on television, and Warner Brothers saw me, and in another of these improbable twists of fate, they offered me a job as a young hippie rock doc to accompany this movie they were making about the Grateful Dead and the Jefferson Airplane and Jethro Tull and Pink Floyd. And I talked to my wife, and we agreed it would be a lot of fun to be a rock doc on a movie. And so I said yes. So we did it. And my first job, my first day, was to vaccinate the cast against smallpox. Why? Well, because the cast was going to go to Europe, and to come back into the United States in those days, you had to have a little yellow card that said you had a smallpox vaccination.
So how did you meet Wavy Gravy?
So I was vaccinating the crew, and Wavy was one of the very first people I vaccinated. And when he smiled and I saw that he had rainbow-colored teeth, that every one of his teeth, Vibgior, violet, indigo, blue, green, yellow, orange, you know, that acronym, that he had real rainbow teeth. And he had a duckbill hat that had a real duck's bill on it. And I knew that I hadn't ever met anybody quite like Wavy Gravy before.
So for people who've never heard of Wavy Gravy, can you describe this man? Because he really sounds like one of a kind.
He was on the bus and part of the Merry Pranksters. He then started his own commune, kind of a parallel to Ken Kesey's commune called the Hog Farm. And the Hog Farm was invited to go to Woodstock and to provide food.
And Wavy Gravy was actually the MC at the Woodstock Festival.
He was the MC, and he's famously said after the rains and people woke up in the morning and it was muddy, he said, "Don't get out of bed, because what I have in mind is breakfast in bed for 400,000. And he said, "The Hog Farm will be coming to you and introducing you to a new kind of food called granola." And the clown persona is just his way of getting around in costume.
Of disarming people, too, right? I mean, he's always been an activist, but he wanted to get people to drop their defenses.
Yeah, Wavy doesn't have any enemies. You're not going to find people who say, let's go out and beat up Wavy Gravy. That's just not the way it works.
The police beat him up a lot, though.
The police beat him all up a lot before he became a clown. And that was one of the reasons he became a clown and an Easter Bunny at Easter and Santa Claus at Christmas, because he learned that police then in those days, and probably not now, do not want to be photographed beating up Santa Claus or the Easter Bunny. But he did not feel that the police were his enemies in any way. He just wanted to make a statement about the war in Vietnam or about civil rights. And the Hog Farm became an instrument for him and for many other people to show up at protest marches and feed people.
So you met a lot of the icons of the 60s. Ken Kesey, Tim Leary, the apostle of LSD, Richard Alpert, Leary's one-time Harvard colleague, later became Ram Dass. It must have been pretty heady stuff.
Yeah, you're talking about my friends now. You know, certainly Ram Dass, and my wife and I lived in the same ashram that he lived in the Himalayas. We were taken by his book, Be Here Now. Ken Kesey stayed in my apartment in San Francisco many times. And of course, Tim Leary, who was Richard Alpert's colleague.
Now, how did psychedelics figure into that whole scene? LSD, psilocybin, and the other stuff that was going around?
Well, I think it was part of the water we drank just about. And it was certainly on the Medicine Ball Caravan, on this movie, which was the only time I took LSD and psilocybin in large quantities over a very intense period of time. It was part of the caravan, and it was an amazing time for me.
Did that change you?
It definitely changed me. It made me unable to go down the road that I was going down as an activist. You know, the peace march, the nonviolence, was leading into a violent kind of anti-war, the SDS becoming the weatherman, that transition. I couldn't go there. I couldn't see how people would pick up guns, especially after taking psychedelics. The idea of guns was impossible to me. The violence, the bombing of the State Department. I mean, I couldn't be part of anything that was violent.
Why did psychedelics contribute to that that frame of mind?
Because you feel under in those days, and I'm not an advocate for drugs in any form. I want to make that very clear. Although, certainly for me, in those days, the psychedelic experience made me feel like we are all related to each other, like the Indians say. We're all in it together. So how could you ever do violence to another?
Now, you and your wife, Elaine, she later changed her name, but you joined Wavy Gravy on the Hog Farm bus, and it was quite an odyssey, at least as you write about it. What was this all about, this bus trip?
Well, first of all, we had an expression in those days, you're either on the bus or you're off the bus. We were really on the bus, there's no question. And Wavy and the hog farm, that we were not formally part of at that point, decided they wanted to continue on the road and buy another bus, turned out to be two buses, and drive from London through Europe and Turkey and Iran and Afghanistan and Iraq and into Pakistan and India and up either to Nepal or to go to Bangladesh, which Wavy thought we should do to bring food and medical supplies to people who had been devastated by a cyclone in 1972. And Girish and I, my wife Elaine and I, traveled with the bus from Istanbul to Kathmandu. And that was an amazing experience.
And you tell stories. I mean, a whole bunch of amazing stories. One is, I mean, you have to talk about this time when you were in India, I think staying not far from the Taj Mahal, and Wavy Gravy is sort of walking through these streets just filled with beggars. I mean, people, you know, with nothing to eat. And he comes up with this crazy idea that he's going to feed everyone there. Can you describe what happened?
Yeah, I mean, first I want to say that when we were in Afghanistan and Iran and Pakistan and the Muslim part of India in those days, where I would go out as a doctor into little villages, wherever we stopped, I would stop and open up a medical tent. We'd go into these little villages and I would be treating people, and they would take us and show us the altar, you know, the shrine in the middle of the village. And if it was a Buddhist village, there'd be a statue of Buddha. If it was a Hindu village, there would be maybe a statue of Ram. If it was a Muslim village, there'd be a photo of Mecca. But not in every village, but in maybe one out of three or two out of 10 of those villages, right on that altar next to a picture of Mecca or Buddha or Ram, there would be a picture of John F. Kennedy.
Fascinating.
That's who we looked like to them. That's aspirationally who they thought of as America. And that's why they were so nice to us. We must have looked like Martians. We had a hippie bus. It was painted crazy colors. And so when we got to India, Wavy got the idea, why don't we feed everybody in Benares, which is a town devoted to beggars and to people who come at the end of their life. And it's the place where many Indians go to become cremated. What we didn't realize is the night that he had picked was the what's called Shiva Ratri, the night of Shiva. And on that night in India, the food is prepared ceremonially with marijuana. And it is almost impossible to eat or drink anything. This is still true today. In Benares on that night, that it doesn't have a little bit of bung in it, which is a kind of low-potency marijuana. Well, I certainly didn't know that, and Wavy didn't know that. But he went around telling everybody that we were going to make food for hundreds of people, as the hog farm had done at Woodstock. I got quite sick, and I had a form of paratyphoid or just some bad gastrointestinal disease. And so out of an abundance of caution so that I wouldn't contaminate all the food, I had sequestered myself on top of the bus and brought, I thought, a sufficient supply of toilet paper and a blanket that I could stay in and keep myself away from getting people sick. And Wavy went around and kept on telling people there's free food here. And we thought maybe 100, 200 people would show up, and we didn't realize that they would all be inebriated and that there would be thousands who would come for our food. And we ran out of food.
Wow.
And then we were circled by hungry people and then another circle, and the pressure on the bus was so great because we had totally run out of food. And the
You who were in agony, away from the hordes down below, who then started rocking the bus because
they started rocking the bus, and the buses began to drive away very slowly and then very carefully.
Now, to jump ahead in the story a little bit, so you've already had your taste of India, and you end up going back to India. Your wife has spent a lot of time at an ashram with the famous Hindu spiritual guru, Neem Karoli Baba, and you end up going there as well. How did that happen?
My wife decided that she wanted to find the guru of Baba Ramdas, Neem Karoli Baba, and so she had gone to his ashram, and war had broken out between India and Pakistan, and we could not communicate with each other very well. Phone calls were difficult to come by. Telegrams were often misinterpreted. She would say in her telegrams to me, "Come here immediately," And I would get back telegrams that seemed to say, I am living with another man. And the part about him being a guru and Neem Karoli Baba wasn't all that clear. So our communication was a little complicated. And in the end, we negotiated a settlement that she would come back to San Francisco for Christmas. And I would pledge to go back to India with her to meet this man, Neem Karoli Baba. And we went to live for what turned out to be a couple of years.
But when you first got there, I mean, your wife was totally committed. I mean, this is what she wanted to do with her life. And you say that it was a hard landing for you. I mean, you thought you were going to have this amazing transformative experience. As soon as you got there, you didn't.
No, that's right. I knew I wanted to find something that would change me into a better person spiritually. I'd been reading the Old Testament and the New Testament and the Bhagavad Gita, but I hadn't found the right thing for me, and I was so hoping that by going back and staying in this ashram that had, where Ram Dass had been changed and so many others, that I too would become changed. But the first couple of weeks there, the scene seemed pagan to me. There were all these idols, these young Americans that were touching this old man's feet. I mean, it just seemed like I was not destined to be part. I thought it was a cult. I thought my wife had been captured by a cult.
And the way you write about this is, I mean, when things weren't working out with you there, they weren't working out in your marriage as well. I mean, it looked like
that's right.
Things were going to fall
that's
apart.
Right. Oh, because if my wife had to choose between her guru and me, there was no contest. And I loved her very much, and I didn't want to lose her. And I had my own dark night of the soul, except it was during the day. And I went out on a lake near the ashram in Nainital. I started thinking about God. I think I recited every prayer that I'd ever learned, whether it was Hebrew or whether it was Tibetan, Sanskrit. I was trying to find a way to get a sign that it was the right place for me to stay. But I got nothing back. I was bargaining with God. I mean, just give me an oil slick with a little rainbow in the oil slick. Nobody else needs to see it. I'll take that. But nothing. I thought, she's been captured by a cult, and it isn't my cult.
So you were going to leave at that point?
I packed my bags. We cried. We hugged. The next morning, she said, you're leaving, but would you at least go and say goodbye to him? And I said, yeah, I think it's a cult, but I was raised to be courteous. I'll go say goodbye to him. And we packed everything in a taxi, and we went down to the ashram, and I told the taxi driver to wait, and we went in to say goodbye to him. And he was in his room, and there was a, we call it a tucket. It was just a wooden cot that he would sit on, and it had a little blanket on it. And the villagers who adored him, who worshiped him, who venerated him, had made a what's called a mandala out of flowers and fruits. They had brought them in. It's like a drawing. But they had, instead of a drawing, they had written the name of Ram, which is the name of God, Ram. And they had made the name of Ram out of apples and oranges and flower petals. And one of the apples had fallen down. It had rolled off the cot. And so I reached down to pick up the apple to put it back on the tucket to complete the name of God. And Neem Karoli Baba, who we called Maharaji, he burst out of his room. He saw me. He saw my hand on the ground picking up the apple, and he stepped on my hand. And all of a sudden, my worst nightmare, I was touching his feet. And I couldn't get my hand out from under his foot. And he pinned me down there. And he started to laugh, and he said, and it's the first time he had ever said anything to me. I'd been there for more than a week. He never even noticed me. And now he looked at me, he said, you weren't here yesterday. And, you know, it's an awkward position to be down on your knees.
Yeah. You just want to get the hell out of there, right?
I couldn't get the apple out of my hand. He's standing on my hand. You were not here yesterday. I said, that's true, yeah. He's speaking Hindi, which I understand a little bit of. And then he said, you weren't here yesterday. Were you sick? No, you weren't sick. And he's talking to himself. He said, were you flying a kite? No, you weren't flying a kite. Were you swimming in the lake? And I'm thinking, that's the most polluted lake on the planet. He's not really seriously. He said, no, you were at the lake, but but you weren't swimming. What were you doing at the lake? And up until now, he'd only spoken in Hindi, but lake he said in English, and I felt a kind of shudder in my back. And then he looked down at me and says, what were you doing at the lake yesterday? Oh, yes, you were talking to God. Did you ask for a sign? And he said that in English. And when he said it, it was like everything in my life had pointed towards that moment, and I started to cry. And I'm a scientist. There was nothing in my rational mind or in my science training that could explain that he knew that I was.
Hadn't told your wife that you what you had done.
No,
out on
I hadn't
the
told
lake.
Anybody, and certainly nobody knew I'd been trying to recite every prayer I had memorized in every different language, so a sign would appear. And then he sat me down and he said, but my hand is still pinned down there. And then he released my hand and he started rubbing my beard. I was crying and he was wiping away my tears. And he said, Dr. America. That was the name he gave me, Dr. America. And he started telling me about my past and my future. And by then, all the other young Americans who had come there, the 20 or 30 who were there, and the French and the Europeans who had come there, they arrived at the ashram and they came around and they started to hug me. And I realized later that every one of them had gone through an experience like that. I mean, they say in all the ancient texts that the teacher will initiate you. I had some idea. You'd walk into a room, put a robe on, and you'd do some incantation. There'd be candles and, you know, some part. This was my initiation.
How do you explain that? I mean, how do you explain that he knew this dark night of the soul or dark day of the soul for you and that, you know, you'd lost hope and this was the moment that he was going to reach out to you?
I can't explain it, nor can I explain how years later he told me out of the blue that I would be transformed yet again from Dr. America into UNO doctor and work for the United Nations and work to help to eradicate smallpox. I mean, maybe somebody could have seen me on the lake. That's possible.
But you don't believe conjecture. That. I mean, you something else.
No, I don't believe it, but I try to honestly answer the question, what do I think happened? I don't know.
So before we go on and sort of talk about that story, just tell me a little bit about this remarkable man named Karoli Baba, whom you called Maharishi. I mean, he was unlike anyone else you've ever known, right?
Oh, yeah. It was like everybody else in the ashram was a movie in black and white, and he was in Technicolor. But I don't think it's the magic part or the, you know, ascribing superpowers to him part or that is the least bit interesting to me. How he captured my heart was that when I sat in front of him and he was talking about the lake and maybe reading my mind, I don't know, I knew that he loved everybody in the world. I could feel the love coming from him. But it was not a surprise to me that he loved everybody in the world. He was supposed to. That was his job. He had the job title of guru, dispeller of darkness. But what had happened in that moment was that I felt that I loved everybody in the world. And I had never felt like I loved everybody in the world. To me, there were cops and there were marchers. There were soldiers and there were Vietnamese. Everything had been binary. But in that moment and in many moments since then, I don't feel like there's anyone I hate. And that was not something that I was prepared for.
Yeah.
And that is the reason that I stayed.
So you took on sort of this role as Dr. America, as he called you, and then he had this weird prophecy for you that you would go and work with the United Nations and somehow work on a campaign to help eradicate smallpox. And to just put into context how unlikely this was, I mean, you'd never done anything with epidemiology. You weren't a public health doctor. India didn't even have a campaign against smallpox at the time. They sort of had, you know, sidelined that whole issue, even though it was raging in India. Tell me how that happened.
He called us into his area one day and he said, you will go work for the United Nations and you will go to villages and you will give vaccinations. And this terrible Mahamari, this epidemic, this disease called smallpox will be eradicated and you will get your job. And that was really preposterous he sent me down to the World Health Organization building. I still had an ashram gown on. I had a beard down to the middle of my belly, and I had hair down to the middle of my back. And I was an improbable person to go work for the United Nations. And I was 10 years younger than anybody they'd ever hired before. So they kicked me out, and I came back. And he said, "You'll get it, go back." And I went back, and they kicked me out again. And that ping-ponging trip, about a day and a half, 17 hours or so.
Wow.
A bus, a train, a rickshaw, and I kept doing it.
I mean, that must have been so weird. I mean, you'd show up at the local UN office and, you know, say, "Hey, I'm here for this job." And they say, "We don't want you," and you keep coming back.
It was really weird. It was humiliating, and I lost faith any number of times. I thought, this is, you know, weird, and I'm not going to do this. And then something else would happen, and he would convince me to go do it. And like one day he said, "You got to go this very second. This is the 12th or 13th time that I'd made this trip. Right now, this very second, go. And I really didn't want to go, but I did. And I took a bus and I went down there and I walked into the office. There was another American there, first time I'd seen another American there. And he said, "Hello, who are you?" And I said, "My name's Larry Brilliant. I'm a doctor, but I live in an ashram in the Himalayas." And he said, "What are you here for?" I said, "Well, my guru, who lives in the Himalayas, said that I'm supposed to work for the smallpox program. It's going to be eradicated, you know. It's God's gift to humanity." "What do you do?" He said, "Oh, I'm head of the smallpox program from Geneva." "And I just happen to be here because I'm meeting tomorrow morning with Mrs. Gandhi to try to persuade her that we should have a smallpox program in India." And again, I felt like a fool. 10 years later, when D.A. Henderson, this man who met me then, when he asked me to turn off the lights on the program, and we had successfully eradicated smallpox, and I was to pack up all the boxes and get the microfilm, I found his notes from that meeting that day, 10 years earlier, where he said, "I've met a young man today, Larry Brilliant. Seems like a very nice man. He says he's a doctor. He does not look like a doctor. Appears to have gone native," is what he wrote about me.
And there's a long story then. You proved your worth, basically, and you got involved in not just the administrative stuff, but then you started going out and doing site visits, and miraculously, your team wiped out smallpox.
It is a miracle, I think. I mean, it's easy to understand it now in retrospect. The science of it is pretty clear. But it wasn't so easy then. We had to find every single case of smallpox in India at the same time and put a ring of immunity around it. And that meant we had to go door to door, house to house, village to village. And there were nearly 200,000 children who had smallpox in India when I was there.
This is the early 1970s, right?
In the early 1970s and the middle 1970s. And a third of them died, one out of every three. And we had to go and knock on. We had 150,000 people ultimately on our little team. It wasn't so little as we grew it. And we had people from 171 nations. And the message for this time, this particular time, when there's so much vitriol in the air and there's so much animosity between religions and races, people, I'd like to know that in the middle of the Cold War, Russians and Americans, as well as people from 170 nations, came together. Every religion. There were Jews and Christians and Muslims and Buddhists and Hindus and Jains. And you can't even begin to list the religions. And people with every color of the rainbow came together. And we worked together. And never the Russians and the Americans, instead of fighting against each other, we took that energy and fought together on the same side to eradicate smallpox. As you know now from reading that book, I had the privilege of seeing the last case of variola major, of killer smallpox, a young girl named Rahima Banu, who in October of 1975, when she completed smallpox and she did not die, that was the last case in a chain, an unbroken chain of transmission of killer smallpox that went all the way back to Pharaoh Ramses, and probably beyond, probably 10,000 years, billions of people died of smallpox. The miracle is that the people came together and did it. The magic is the science, but it's the people that's the miracle.
That's Larry Brilliant talking with Steve Paulson. Later, Larry became the first executive director of Google.org, and he now chairs the Skoll Global Threats Fund. His new memoir is called Sometimes Brilliant. I'm Anne Strainchamps. If you like conversations with writers, thinkers, and cultural figures, you should be a regular listener. For more episodes of To the Best of Our Knowledge, check our podcast feed. You'll find us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you download your favorite podcasts. To the Best of Our Knowledge is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio, based in Madison, Wisconsin, and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.